Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I'd like to welcome you all to my program, the Michael Cutler Hour. Always good to join you at the end of the week so we get to rehash the loony stuff that goes on. I am absolutely convinced that Rod Serling has been writing the script of late. Anyway, for those of you who are new to the program, I welcome you. My name is Michael Cutler. I'm a retired senior special agent of what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Today it's known as ICE, a division of DHS, an agency that, quite frankly, I've come to call the Department of Homeland Surrender. We have many issues to discuss today. Usually I bring a guest on, but there's so much happening that I made a decision today, and it's good when you have your own program because you can make these decisions. I thought that I would spend my entire time with you by myself, flying solo, as they say, but you're certainly welcome to call in and join the conversation. My phone number here is 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. What's incredible to me, and we talk about this all the time, and people say, well, how on earth can you talk about immigration ceaselessly? And the answer to that is quite easy, because immigration is not a singular issue, but a singular issue. It impacts just about every threat and challenge that confronts our country and our citizens. It's not about bashing lawful immigrants. You know, my mother, may she rest in peace, was an immigrant. My dad's parents were immigrants. So many of my friends and neighbors came here from other countries legally. America was built on the sweat, on the efforts, on the talent, on the dedication, on the moxie, if you will, the chutzpah, of immigrants who came to America from the four corners of the planet. I'm a New Yorker. New York is probably the most ethnically diverse city, certainly in the United States, if not the world. But the idea that we have open borders, the idea that we now have millions of people inside our country and we have no way of knowing who they are or whether or not they pose a threat to our safety or well-being is incomprehensible. The immigration laws, to put it very succinctly, in six words or less, the immigration laws are supposed to protect American lives and protect American jobs. How on earth anybody who calls himself or herself a leader in this perilous era and in this era of economic turmoil could not think that those two goals should be the priorities? What can I say? Check for a pulse, check for a flatline EEG perhaps. But what I want to do today is talk about a couple of articles because, I have two websites, and if you're listening to the program, you're probably at least familiar with my own website, and that's michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. But I'm also a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, a terrific organization. They are headquartered in a beautiful part of the country, Santa Barbara, California. I was out there not long ago, did a couple of speaking engagements, and that's been one of my goals since the attacks of 9/11, is to get out across America, whether it's on my program, whether it's by appearing on TV or radio or in documentaries or hopping on an airplane and flying to a community and participating in debates and panel discussions and discuss the issues. Because, the First Amendment that everyone says, oh, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, certainly those three freedoms are right there front and center, but they've left out two other very important components if they don't talk about these other two components of the First Amendment of our Bill of Rights. Number one, the right to seek redress of grievances. And boy, if you look at Washington and many state and city, state capitals and city halls around the country, boy, do we have grievances. And the other component to the First Amendment is to peaceably assemble, the right to peaceably assemble. Now, why is that so important, I ask you? I hope this is rhetorical for you. I hope you already know the answer. But the founding fathers who created this great nation understood that you cannot have a democracy without the free flow of ideas and thoughts and disagreement and discussion and discourse and debate and perhaps argument. That's as American as apple pie. And we don't always agree with each other, and we're not supposed to. Why on earth would anybody suspect or suppose that different people, especially from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds, diverse parts of the country, diverse backgrounds altogether, would agree with each other all the time? Well, we're not going to. So the building of a democracy, you know, democracies are very, very inefficient. But democracies are, at least to this point, the best form of government that anyone has ever come up with. But it does get messy. Somebody once said you wouldn't eat sausage if you saw how they made it. Well, democracy is not much neater than the sausage factory, but it's vital. It is vital to have the discourse. And what disturbs me greatly is that increasingly we are seeing where politicians want to tamp down the discussion. They want to tamp down the debate. They want to treat American citizens like a bunch of mushrooms. We use that term frequently in the government. I worked for the government for 30 years. We used to call it the mushroom treatment. You know, be kept in the dark and to be polite about it, be fed a lot of fertilizer. That's not the American way. We were promised by the Obama administration transparency. Well, somebody needs to get out a bottle of Windex because, boy, oh, boy, there is not much transparency to be found. Whether you want to talk about Operation Fast and Furious, where if you've been following it, and you would have to be living under a stone somewhere to not be aware of Fast and Furious, where at least 2,000 high-powered weapons were all but physically handed over to the Mexican cartels under the name of an investigation into gun trafficking. I mean, absolutely astonishing. When I was an agent, and let me be clear about this, because when I speak about these issues, and I think perhaps why it's important that I do what I do, is not because I have all the answers, because I'm brilliant or whatever, but because I do have an extensive background in law enforcement as an immigration agent. And just to quickly run through my background again for any new listeners who may be joining us this evening, I spent 30 years with the INS going way back to October 1971, a long time ago when I was sworn in as an immigration inspector at Kennedy Airport. I did that job for 4 years, and then I became a special agent, or back then we were called criminal investigators, in 1975, and I've rotated through all the divisions within the investigations branch. I was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division at DEA, and then I became a senior special agent in 1991 and was assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. And I worked with the FBI and DEA and ATF and IRS and the U.S. Marshals Service. I also worked with local and state police, and I worked with foreign governments, including the law enforcement agencies of Israel, Canada, Great Britain, and Japan, to name four of the ones that I did most of my work with where it concerned foreign governments. So I've seen investigations from every angle you might possibly imagine, and perhaps from some angles you might not imagine. And when we handed over contraband to the bad guys as part of an investigation, it was always referred to as a controlled delivery, to maintain control over the contraband. I know of one case where we were giving out green cards to criminals from Jamaica, and the idea was that they were swapping dope for the green cards. We worked with the FBI. They thought that they had encountered a crooked immigration agent when in fact it was simply an INS agent working in an undercover capacity. He wasn't a crooked agent, but he played one on TV, so to speak. And so the bad guys were handing over the dope and they were getting the green cards. And every time this agent who was running the case applied for additional green cards, Washington was all over him. Oh, no, no, you've already given out five. Do we really need to give out a sixth one? And it was a very tightly controlled situation. And we're talking about a piece of paper. And that green card had on it a file number. So even if the guy showed the card to anybody, if immigration authorities or a law enforcement agency came to immigration and asked about his file, when you opened up the file, right there in the middle of this immigration folder that related purely to that green card was a clear indication that the guy that had the card was a crook and he had only been given the card in furtherance of an undercover narcotic sting. So it didn't even really convey authority. I mean, the guy might have gotten a job that way. But the point was, we had pretty good control over him and the document and how he could use it. And boy, oh boy, it was tighter than a drumhead trying to get extra documents to be issued to any of the bad guys because headquarters went to the Justice Department and this thing was really taken deadly seriously. Now, I want you to contrast that kind of tight control imposed on an undercover investigation with what we're talking about as a piece of paper, as compared with the ATF giving guns that were fully functioning to straw purchasers. And why they call them straw, think of a scarecrow out in the field. The guy stands there, but he's not really buying the guns for himself. He's buying them for somebody else, perhaps an illegal alien, perhaps somebody with felony convictions, or in this case, the cartels. So if the cartel member came in, there's no way he'd get through the Brady requirements of fingerprinting and so forth. So the bad guys were putting up straw purchases. And the gun dealers knew that there was something lousy with this deal, but they were told by ATF to let the guns walk, let them go. Now, these weren't guns that were non-functioning. These were fully functional weapons, including AK-47s and 50 caliber machine guns. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, just a couple of days before Christmas a year ago, pardon me, was actually, we believe, killed by one of those guns inside the United States. Those guns aren't going to stay in Mexico, folks. And I mean, look at the carnage in Mexico today. 45,000 Mexicans slaughtered by the cartels since Felipe Calderon, the current president of Mexico, took office. But those guns are headed back into the United States. You can be as certain of that as you can that the Swallows will return to Capistrano, you know. The guns are coming here in part so that the drug dealers across this country who operate under the cartel in Mexico will make certain to maintain control over the drug trade and the money, and they do so by violence. And that's the way the drug traffickers work, by intimidation, by violence, by the threat of violence, and by carrying out murders and crimes of violence that mimic in so many ways the way that the terrorists operate. And meanwhile, of course, we're being told by Janet Napolitano, the secretary of DHS, as I say, the Department of Homeland Surrender, oh, you have nothing to worry about. There's no violence spilling across the border. In fact, Fox Latino asked me to write a commentary, and I understand that they want me to write more commentaries for them, and I am delighted that I will be getting my voice heard on the Fox News website, the Fox Latino News website. And they said, well, Mike, what do you make of this allegation by Napolitano that violence isn't spilling across the border? Because a couple of weeks ago, a woman in her 40s was pushing a baby stroller through the streets of El Paso, and I've been to El Paso. It's right across the border from one of the most violent cities in the Western Hemisphere, Ciudad Juarez. And as she was pushing the stroller, minding her own business, a bullet apparently fired in Mexico during a blazing gun battle over drugs, what else, flew across the border, hit her in the leg. Fortunately, she was not seriously wounded. Fortunately, imagine if the bullet had penetrated the stroller. I believe there was a baby in the stroller. You may have had a dead child. And Napolitano said, oh, this is a rarity. We don't have spillover from Mexico. We don't have that problem. And, you know, you listen to the story, and I will tell you, if you know anybody who is able to do rhinoplasty, then what I can tell you is send them to see Janet Napolitano. Her nose is growing every time she talks about the security of our borders and every time she says there's no spillover, because it's not just the Mexican border. I keep repeating myself, but I have to repeat myself because it's a message that few people are willing to talk about. Illegal immigration impacts virtually every city and state in this country. And let me give you a couple of examples. Let's look at one of the things. By the way, here's an interesting story that just popped up within the last day. ISA, this is the headline, ISA presses Napolitano on allegations of false border crossing data. Well, think about that. Apparently, people inside DHS, inside the Border Patrol, reached out to Daryl Issa, congressman from California, who heads the government, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, Internal Affairs, if you will. And that's really what Congress is. If you know how our government is structured, Congress is supposed to impose oversight over the federal agencies that we, the people, pay our taxes to run. They are the people that are supposed to come back to us and tell us whether we're getting our money's worth. And I don't think we even have to have a conversation about whether or not we're getting our money's worth, especially where immigration law enforcement and the border has been concerned. But anyway, apparently people were saying, no, she's cooking the books. Lots more people are being arrested or turned around so that the arrest statistics are lower. Now, this is really remarkable. Because about, I think it was December 21st, in fact, looking at my notes, I was on with Neil Cavuto. Neil has a great couple of programs, one on Fox and the other on Fox Business. Well, on December 21st, I was with Neil on Fox Business. Love to join him on the air. I've been on his program many times. And Neil said to me, he said, you know, Mike, I think that the numbers of illegal aliens in the United States are down. And it's based on this idea that there are fewer arrests. And I remember perhaps I was being a bit glib, but I've always found that humor seems to help. And when you look at this disaster, if you don't laugh, you have to cry. And what I said was, well, wait a moment, Neil. Trying to figure out how many illegal aliens are present in the United States simply by looking at how many people get arrested by the Border Patrol is kind of like taking attendance but asking people not present to raise their hands. It's the craziest deal in the world to say, oh, we know how many people are in the United States because we know that the arrests are down. There is no real formula to know how many people get arrested and how many people evade the Border Patrol. And again, it's not just the Mexican border. We have aliens coming in through seaports and through the marinas. We have 95,000 miles of coastline in the United States. Think of how many boats sail in and out of marinas, could meet boats at sea, pick up packages containing drugs or, God forbid, one day a weapon of mass destruction and people. We have seaports with stowaways. I was the Marine Intelligence Officer in New York for a bunch of years. I used to go out with the customs boarding parties, out with the Coast Guard, search the ships for stowaways and contraband. And we have at least 5 million illegal aliens in our country who didn't run our borders but came through ports of entry and then one way or the other violated the terms of their admission into the United States. So here we have the administration saying, oh, no, no, immigration, the problem is solved. No, the numbers are going down, the economy stinks, so nobody is coming here anymore. It's a lie. Every time they talk about immigration, it's a lie. They tell us that they want to create jobs, but have you heard any of our supposed leaders talk about the need to liberate jobs? Have you heard anybody say, you know something? We really need to liberate jobs. We need to enforce the immigration laws because right now they jump up and down and they say, wow, they created 100,000 jobs last week. 100,000 jobs, and we're all supposed to say, whoopee. Meanwhile, how many millions of Americans are out of work? And this false number of 8.4% or 8.3%, they you know, mess around with the numbers. They keep on cooking the books. They don't talk about people who are underemployed working as hamburger flippers, not that there's something wrong with flipping a hamburger until you try to support your family on that paycheck. They don't talk about people who've been out of work for years, so they have fallen out of their benefits program, so they don't count. They don't talk about people who've stopped looking for work. The 8% number is as real as the tooth fairy. And they know it, and we all know it, but they keep spewing these ridiculous numbers, and we're told that everything is just hunky-dory, and everything is wonderful, and the sun's going to shine tomorrow. But those of us who have the ability to question and reason understand that that's not the case. We've got a serious problem. So on top of the fact that simply talking about arrest records isn't enough, now we have information being received by ISA, who, by the way, along with Senator Chuck Grassley, another one of my personal favorite folks in Washington, along with Steve King and Congressman Lou Barletta and Peter King of New York and a few really great leaders in Congress, ISA and Grassley have been leading the charge on Operation Fast and Furious, and now ISA is going after this issue at DHS about whether or not we're even getting accurate arrest numbers coming out of the DHS. I think we know the answer to that, don't we? So it's, again, lie after lie after lie. It gets old. It gets boring. It gets tiring. But that's what we're treated to by a government that we were promised would be transparent. Absolutely astonishing. Then there's a story that I just wrote this in a commentary for CAPS. And, again, I would remind you their website is capsweb.org. This also appears on my website, michaelcutler.net. Belizean gang member sentenced to 64 months for illegally reentering the United States. He was an aggravated felon who had been deported four times before. This story kind of pleased me, and I'll give you a little background on it. When you read the article, you'll see why. I've always been a troublemaker, something that I'm very proud of. I think it's in my genetic makeup. Back in the early 80s, I found it was almost impossible to get the U.S. Attorney's Office to accept prosecutions on illegal aliens who got deported and then came back illegally. You see, the way it works in the system, it's not enough that you find somebody who violated a law. You also have to get the U.S. Attorney's Office, the federal prosecutors, to agree to take the case. In that setting, in effect, the U.S. attorney becomes your attorney and you're their client if you're a case agent. So you go to the U.S. attorney and you say to the guy, you go to the U.S. attorney who's over on what they call intake, to give you a little bit of insight, and you sell the case. Well, I've got this guy, and he was deported three times before, and then they say to you, well, has he any criminal convictions? Well, no. Did he have a weapon on him when you found him? No. So he was just deported three times, and you want us to prosecute him? We don't have the resources. And besides Agent Cutler, the worst this guy is going to get is 2 years in jail, and by the time it's all over with, he'll probably be sentenced to time served. Why bother? So they would refuse the case. Time and again, they would refuse the case. I mean, it really had to be sexy. Yes, the guy shot at a police officer, the bullet grazed him, and then he ran for five blocks, and he stole a car, and he beat somebody over the head. And then the U.S. attorney says, well, can they charge him with attempted murder of the police officer? Well, yes, but there's a problem with the case, and if you got lucky, maybe they would accept the case. And what I started to realize was that part of the problem was that two-year sentence. Because the U.S. attorney said, well, you know, it doesn't make sense. By the time we put time, money, effort, and limited resources that we have into that case, he'll get time served and he'll be on his way home anyway. So I got together with Senator D'Amato, who in those days was the senior senator from the state of New York, and I approached him and his people and said, they need to make a separate law that says that if you're a criminal and you get deported and you come back to the United States, you are now looking at 20 years in jail. Let's make it clear to the dirtbags that we don't want you back here. The door swings one way and one way only, and if you dare set foot here again, we will drop a safe on your head, just like they do in my favorite Looney Tune cartoons. So, you know, that was my premise. And D'Amato and his people said, look, if you can get other agents to come forward and substantiate the things that you're pushing for, we'll see what we can do. And so I was able, one way or the other, to cajole, convince, embarrass, I'm not sure what it was I did, but over a six-month period, I convinced 30 of my colleagues at INS to go to see Senator D'Amato over that six-month period and convince him not only about that, but we had a couple of other items on our agenda. We wanted the INS to make criminal aliens the priority over non-criminals. Now, let me stop here just for a quick statement. The Obama administration, as you well know, is claiming that they're not going to arrest aliens who have no convictions because they're going to go after the bad guys only. That was something that we never would have wanted when we went to D'Amato. Prioritizing doesn't mean to the exclusion of everything else. It just means it's your priority, you see. So when they say that, when we said, let's prioritize criminals, what we had in mind was the efforts to locate illegal aliens should focus on the aliens who have convictions, but if you encounter during the course of the investigation other illegal aliens, you take them into custody and you seek to deport them. And you do this to create a deterrence. It's not that you're going out of your way to look for these folks, but if they land in your lap because you knock on a door looking for somebody and the wrong guy is now living in that apartment, you take him into custody and the word is out on the street that if you're here illegally, you should never put your head down on your pillow with the expectation that immigration isn't an issue. That's how you discourage people from running the border. You don't tell people, hey, listen, if you run the border, we want to make you a citizen. If you run the border, we want to give you in-state tuition a la DREAM Act. And by the way, the DREAM Act is another bit of propaganda because it's not about children. It would cover aliens up to their 35th birthday. So a lot of smoke and mirrors, a lot of mistruths, half-truths, and bald-faced lies, and lots of accusations. For example, people like me who want to see the immigration laws enforced are often accused of being anti-immigrant. The violence generally that we associate with the transnational gangs, not just from Mexico, folks. It could be from Russia. It could be from Asia. It could be from the Caribbean, Jamaica, Trinidad, whatever. The violence is felt most often among members of the same ethnicity within the immigrant communities. But the fantasy persists that if you want the border secured, you want the laws enforced, you're against immigrants. It's a lie. And by the way, the laws that they hate also have provisions that enable more than 1.1 million aliens each and every year to enter the United States legally with a green card, which immediately puts them on the pathway to citizenship. So when you hear the stories, oh my God, no wonder they run the border, there's no legal way to come here. Bunk. There is a legal system, and America is the most generous of all the countries on the planet. I will not tell you that I've confirmed this, but I have heard it said that America's 1.1 million plus immigrants that we admit every year is more than the rest of the world admits each year. I don't know if that's accurate, but it's certainly a lot more than any other country admits. And I try to be as careful and accurate with my statistics as possible, unlike Ms. Napolitano, who likes to play fast and loose with her numbers. And the other suggestion that we made to Al D'Amato was that we should be holding deportation hearings inside the prisons. It makes no sense that a criminal alien sits in jail for 15 years for committing a rape or arson or murder, and then when we release him, they say, well, now we're going to try to deport the guy. So the first thing that happens is he goes before an immigration judge, and the judge lets him out on bail, and now he becomes a fugitive and maybe kills or rapes somebody else. So the thought that I came up with was that if you hold the hearings in the prisons, you have a captive audience. Hold the hearing within the first year, and for the next 10, 15 years, however long his sentence is, this guy could appeal his order of deportation to his grandmother, for all that matters, get him on an airplane, and move him out of the country. That's how you solve the problem of recidivism where criminal aliens are concerned. So we provided those three ideas, and there was a gentleman by the name of Walter Connery, and Walt used to be the chief of investigations in New York before he came to the INS. He was the head of internal affairs for the New York City Police Department, one of my favorite bosses. I still consider him a friend. He's retired. But Walt is also an attorney. And unbeknownst to him, and he didn't know what we were doing, and I didn't know what he was doing, but apparently a couple of months after we approached Al D'Amato about changing the Ag-Felon statute, Walter had written a legislative initiative where he laid out the same idea, and Al D'Amato ran with it. So, in fact, now when you look at the law, if you're a criminal alien and you have been convicted of felonies and you get deported and you come back, guess what, folks? You're looking at a maximum of 20 years in jail. And I had the distinct privilege with my partner way back when they implemented the law, when it changed, of making the very first arrest in the New York District Office for a guy who was a drug dealer and thought I was kidding him when I told him, no, we're taking you out of state prison, not to send you home, but to put you into a new gray bar in with new windows or new bars. And he thought I was kidding until he got sentenced. I was at his sentencing, and it made my day to see that turkey get sentenced to, I believe it was 5 or 6 years in jail for the crime of aggravated felon reentry. And so now we have this Belizean gang member who gets hammered the same way. He gets assigned, he gets sentenced to serve 64 months in prison. And this guy was a one-man crime wave. Let me read what this guy's background was. According to court documents, Francisco, that's the name of this character, is a six-time convicted felon with a criminal history that includes the following convictions: involuntary manslaughter, vehicular manslaughter, robbery, attempted robbery, brandishing a weapon, and illegal reentry. In 1985, Francisco was convicted in California of involuntary manslaughter after stabbing his girlfriend's ex-boyfriend in the chest and killing him. His conviction for vehicular manslaughter occurred in California in 1989. While driving a stolen car, Francisco caused a crash that killed a passenger in another car during his escape attempt after he robbed another victim at knife point. Doing the work, I suppose, that no American wanted to do. I mean, this is so astonishing when you read these stories. I've arrested or been involved with the arrest of thousands of illegal aliens in my career. And for over half of my career, my focus was on criminal aliens involved with drug trafficking. And I've arrested several international terrorists as well. So, you know, my perspective is not based on a hunch or a wild idea or some crazy notion. And yet when you listen to the other side argue against the enforcement of the immigration laws, and you listen to our own leaders in Washington telling us why we don't need to enforce these laws, Nappy, as I sometimes like to call Ms. Napolitano, and believe me, there's no affection in that, has said, oh, it's not a serious deal when someone runs the border. Well, in fact, if the guy was previously deported, it certainly is. Because now you're talking about a guy who might be, looking at a felony charge of 20 years behind bars. If you don't think a 20-year felony is a felony, how did you go to law school? How did you get through public school? The next story I want to talk about is a guy by the name of Haji Bagcho. Interesting name, B-A-G-C-H-O. He was convicted by a federal jury in Washington for drug trafficking and narco-terrorism. He is a citizen of Afghanistan. He is credited, if you want to use that term, with moving the bulk of heroin in Afghanistan. I believe they say that he was moving heroin to 20 different countries from Afghanistan, because you know Afghanistan is a major source country for the poppy. So here's a guy who was funding terrorism. The drugs that he was peddling, and I believe it amounted to 10 or 20% of the world's total production of heroin. I mean, we're talking about a major player here. He was funding terrorism. And what's so remarkable is here we have news released by the Justice Department saying, what a great thing, we got this guy. And indeed, it is a great thing. But here's the problem. With all the talk that we hear from the food police about too much salt on the French fries, too much sugar in the cake, tobacco smoke, and you know, I do think cigarette smoke is dangerous. My dad, may rest in peace, died of lung cancer. But here's my question. Why do we not see a single public service announcement anywhere, not about the perils of salt on the French fries or sugar in our ice cream or cakes, but heroin going into the arms of young people across America? I mean, lots of people, but especially going after the young people before they get hooked. Why aren't we dissuading people from getting themselves hooked on that poison, whether it's cocaine, whether it's heroin, whether it's meth, whether it's crack? Not a word. Occasionally, you'll hear a story. Chuck Schumer, our senator here in New York, who they say is the most dangerous place in Washington, is to get between Chuck and a video camera, news camera. Oh, we're going to go after the people that are stealing, you know, the oxycodone and the other, you know, diversion of prescription painkillers and so forth. Is that a problem? Yes, it is. And in fact, up at DEA, they have a division known as diversion. Diversion, by the way, is not what you do to keep busy when there's nothing going on. That's a different kind of diversion. At DEA, the people that deal with diversion are talking about the pharmacies that are diverting honest-to-God prescription drugs and allowing them to go out the door to somebody who shouldn't be getting them, because there are people who are hooked on those painkillers. So is that a problem? Yes, and we've seen murders committed in drugstores that were robbed by people who were desperate to get their hands on those drugs. Big problem, but it's not the only problem. But what is so incredible to me is that we have politicians who talk about a war on drugs, they talk about the diversion of prescription drugs, they talk about sugar and salt and tobacco, but not a word about heroin, not a word about cocaine, not a word about meth or crack or those other poisons. You know, we've got to wake up. And it's time that we not only went after interdiction, and I do believe in interdiction. It was a part of my job for half of my career with the INS because I was part of a task force. But we've got to go after the demand. I remember a time when Bob Stutman, who at the time was the special agent in charge of the New York office of the DEA when I was assigned to DEA intelligence, great assignment. I was up there for 4 years, and then I got promoted to senior special agent. And I would accompany Bob on some of his speaking engagements. And he talked one day about how when he first came to DEA in the late 70s, I guess it was, he said if somebody dropped a kilo of cocaine on a street corner, everybody would be screaming for sanitation to sweep the street up and fire department to hose the street down and get rid of the garbage. back in the late 80s, by the time he was the agent in charge, he said that if someone dropped a brick of cocaine on a street corner, you'd have to call out the riot cops because half the neighborhood would be out on all fours with straws stuck in their nose. So when you look at the tonnage of that evil garbage that's consumed by people across this country each and every day, you have to ask yourself, why on earth is nobody in a position of authority doing anything to educate children and young adults about the perils of getting hooked? It's estimated that probably 70% or more of all crime is directly or indirectly linked to drug use and the drug trade and addiction and so forth. It's a huge public health issue. For all the talk about public health, think what happens to the health of somebody hooked on that garbage. Think of the mortality rate. Not a word. The silence is deafening. So we keep coming back to whether or not we have a transparent government. We keep coming back to whether or not we have a government that truly represents we, the people, the citizens of the United States. And I don't care which party you want to talk about. I think we're disgusted with both parties. I'm not big on what I've seen from the Wall Street occupiers, but I think at least initially these guys had a justifiable hair that grew up their tailpipe because they felt that they were disenfranchised by their own government, which is not far different from what the Tea Party has felt. They may have gone in opposite directions, but they were so far opposite that in some ways they kind of meet in the middle. I think that the American people are smart enough to figure it out that their government is no longer truly representing them. And this is a serious, serious problem. And part of the solution to the problem, folks, is to become involved with your government, which is why I do what I do. Ever since 9/11, I've made it my business to be out here as vocally and as visibly as I can to try to wake you and everyone else up, to try to get our politicians and the other leaders out there to understand the issue. I've been before, I think we're up to 15 congressional hearings. I've testified before state legislative hearings in a number of states, including Texas and Arizona, Indiana. I was the final witness at Hazleton at the trial when, at the time, Mayor Lou Barletta, now he's Congressman Lou Barletta, enacted his own ordinances in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, that largely paralleled the federal government. So that's where we are. You know, we're looking at a situation where our own government is failing to represent us. If you want to join me on the air, you can call in at 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. And I, what I'm trying to do in speaking with you, as I do each week, at the end of each week, is to provide the insight that you're not hearing anyplace else. That's the bottom line. We really don't seem to be getting it here in America. The American people have been too busy playing Xbox and waiting online for the new iPad. Pardon me, I know the new iPad is supposed to be fabulous. But just think, from what I heard, there were people waiting in line for 2 days for an iPad. Could you imagine if our people showed that kind of dedication to get our politicians to actually represent us? Think what would happen then. Now, you know, let's go back for a moment, though, because there's another story that appears on the CAPS website, capsweb.org, again, my website, michaelcutler.net. And here's the headline, and it's a headline, as they say, ripped from the news release that was posted by ICE and by the Department of Justice. And here's the headline. Manager for violent fraudulent document ring sentenced to two life sentences for murdering rival vendor. I want you to think about those words. Here's this guy, and his name is Eddie Olivares Jimenez, a.k.a. Daniel, a.k.a. Erasmo, a.k.a. Ulysses, and a.k.a. Jesus. You know, I look at all those a.k.a.s, I got to laugh. I remember when I was an agent, I used to joke that you could tell the good guy from the bad guy because the good guy would get up in the morning and go through his stuff and figure out what he wanted to wear. A bad guy gets up in the morning, goes through his stuff, and tries to figure out who he wants to be. So I guess Eddie Olivares Jimenez on some days might be Daniel or Erasmo or Ulysses or Jesus or pick some other name, you know, the name of the month club. And here was a guy who operated in 11 different states in 19 different cities. Think of that. 11 states. And we're talking now about Virginia being one of the prime places where he was working out of. Now, I want you to think back to Jonathan Huntsman, the man who had been governor of Utah, who dropped out early on, but he was originally a presidential candidate. Do you remember when he was asked, where do you stand on immigration? And he said, oh, I'm strong on immigration, and if I'm elected president, I'll go to the governors of the four border states. So I guess Mr. Huntsman and other politicians, they talk about the four border states, but George W. Bush, I was the governor of a border state. Any governor in America today, folks, is the governor of a border state. But, you know, again, it's this mythology, it's this game of kabuki theater, and we're being told, well, there's only four states that are border states, California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. So if you're not in one of those states, go back to sleep. This isn't an important issue. Baloney. Because here you have a document vendor who killed somebody, who tortured people. If you read the accounts, it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling. let me read to you. This is an excerpt from the ICE news release. I mean, you have to hear this to believe this. On November 29, 2011, a federal jury convicted Olivares Jimenez of kidnapping and murdering a rival in Little Rock, Arkansas. In July 2010. See, Little Rock is in Arkansas. It's not in Arizona. Don't get confused. It's not one of the border states, according to our political leaders. Posing as a potential client, a conspirator placed a call to the rival and arranged to meet him and an associate in an abandoned trailer house. When the rival entered the home, Olivares, Jimenez, and others attacked him, binding his feet, mouth, and eyes with duct tape. The rival's associate, who also was brought inside, was bound with duct tape and beaten by the attackers. Both men were left bound on the floor, and the rival was later pronounced dead at the scene of the attack. According to the Arkansas Deputy Chief Medical Examiner, he died of asphyxia, blunt force trauma, and blood loss. Well, I guess he had three things going on, didn't he? The jury also convicted Olivares Jimenez for his role in managing cells in Little Rock and Virginia Beach. Again, Virginia now, right? On the East Coast, that produced high-value false identification cards for illegal aliens. He supervised a number of runners who distributed business cards, advertising the organization's services, I love that, and helped facilitate transactions with customers. The cost of fraudulent documents varied depending on the location, with counterfeit resident alien and Social Security cards typically selling for from $150 to $200. Each cell maintained detailed sales records and divided the proceeds between the runner, the cell manager, and the upper-level managers in Mexico. In Mexico. From January 2008 through November 2010, members of the organization wired more than $1 million to Mexico. Do the math. How many thousands of people are buying the documents if $1 million got mailed back to Mexico, got wired to Mexico? Now, here's the cute story. This is a news release issued by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Emphasize immigration, right? That's the I in ICE. There was nothing in the article that ever identified the country of citizenship for this piece of work who has now been sentenced to two life sentences, in part for committing a murder and for running this criminal organization in 19 cities spread across 11 states. How on earth can the Immigration Enforcement Agency, it used to be the INS, not even address the citizenship of this dirtbag who was extremely violent? I mean, this is, again, astonishing. You see this sort of thing and you say to yourself, what on earth are we dealing with? Now, here's something really amazing. You have to listen to this part of this press release about this guy. Remember, now, we don't know if he's a citizen or not. They don't want to talk about it. The new don't ask, don't tell. Throughout the conspiracy, Olivares Jimenez worked under Israel Cruz Milan, a.k.a. El Muerto, which means the dead one, by the way, El Muerto, 26 years old, of Raleigh, North Carolina, yet another state nowhere near the border. Follow along. Who led the organization in the United States and reported to leaders in Mexico. Well, let me tell you my experience as an immigration agent. When you had a criminal organization that was headquartered outside the United States, almost invariably, anybody who is high up in the food chain in that criminal organization inside the United States was of the same nationality as the gang's origins, and it was done for a purpose. Because I guarantee you that if El Muerto refused to do what he was supposed to do, or if money went missing, or something else happened, they have a very unusual way of dealing with problems like that. They don't have a human resource office the way you do in most companies. They just visit the guy's mother, brother, wife, children, whatever, and kill them. So that's why they want to bring in aliens to run the criminal enterprises, because they know that they have the ultimate control over that person. If that person does anything that's at all untowards, his family winds up dead. Again, violence coming across the border, you betcha. But don't expect Napolitano to square to be on the level with you on this either, because, again, Johnny Cochran was right from O.J. Notoriety. If you can't trust the messenger, you can't trust the message. She's had the opportunity to gain our trust by being honest and forthright and forthcoming in the facts. She has not been. So at this point, my ability to believe anything that Mr. Napolitano says is somewhere between slim and none. And as they say, slim just left the building. So let me continue reading this not-so-fairy tale story for you. This is not bedtime reading, by the way. So here we have El Muerto, 26 years old, of Raleigh, North Carolina, who led the organization in the United States, reported to leaders in Mexico. Milan pleaded guilty on November 15, 2011, to racketeering conspiracy, conspiracy to produce and transfer false identification documents, and conspiracy to commit money laundering. On February 16, 2012, U.S. District Judge James R. Spencer sentenced Cruz Milan to 300 months in prison. Testimony at the trial of Olivares Jimenez showed that in June 2009, members of Cruz Milan's organization in Richmond, Virginia, lured two rival sellers to a home, bound them, struck them with a baseball bat, and cut them with a knife, and then placed a semi-automatic handgun in a rival's mouth and warned him about selling false identification documents in Richmond. In November 2010, Cruz Milan and a co-conspirator complained that a rival seller in Nashville, Tennessee, continued to operate on their turf even after they beat him up. Cruz Milan instructed the subordinate to find an empty house to take care of the rival, cautioning him to wear gloves to avoid leaving fingerprints and to avoid using a gun because the gun would make too much noise when fired. Cruz Milan tightly controlled the organization's activities, keeping in regular contact with Olivares Jimenez and other cell managers about inventory, biweekly sales reports, and competition. Members who violated internal rules within the operation were subject to discipline, now catch this, including shaving eyebrows, wearing weights, beatings, and other violent acts. During Olivares Jimenez's trial and Cruz Milan's sentencing hearing, the U.S. presented evidence against Cruz Milan's orchestration of the kidnapping, beating, and torture of an enterprise member who was suspected of stealing from the organization, which is exactly what I was talking about. The event occurred on October 29, 2010, in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's over the border, I think. The evidence presented included telephone calls during which Cruz Milan conducted a conference call with other cell leaders around the United States so they could hear the torture as it took place, and sending a message to other enterprise members about what would happen if they were caught stealing from the criminal organization. The testimony and intercepted calls depicted how the victim was subjected to electric shocks administered by placing his feet in a bucket of water and electrocuting him with jumper cables attached to a car battery. But folks, don't worry, because Janet Napolitano has made it clear there is no violence spilling across the border. My gosh. I wrote about this for the Fox News Latino website a couple of weeks ago. You can go to their website or my website or CAPS website, capsweb.org, because I want people to understand what we're up against. I want you to understand that we are not getting not only our money's worth, but we're not getting proper representation or protection from our own government. One of the things that I do is I often address members of the U.S. military. I work for a speakers bureau in Washington occasionally. And by the way, if you become aware of opportunities where I can get my voice heard, you can reach me through my website, michaelcutler.net, or you can call up CAPS, and I'm sure they would be happy to get in touch with me. But I do speak to the folks in the military. And not long ago, I wrote an article where I challenged this basic premise. Why on earth do we still have a military if we have millions of people inside our country and a porous border that only exists on maps? Because if you look at the primary mission of any country's army, navy, air force, whatever, the Marines, the Coast Guard, it's to keep the enemies as far from the shores of that country as possible. So here's my question. How can our valiant men and women in the armed services achieve their number one objective of keeping our enemies as far from our borders, as far from our shores as possible, when we already have millions, perhaps tens of millions of illegal aliens living in virtually every town and city across this vast nation? We have no reliable way of not only knowing their name, but even their citizenship. Iran right now is on the verge of developing nuclear weapons, we believe. And, you know, it's a tight situation. A lot of stuff going on. And we know that Israel is possibly poised to strike. And we know that Ahmadinejad, the leader of Iran, has said, well, if the Israelis attack us, it will be as though America attacked us, and we will attack America. There was an article in the Washington Times last year, and that article was predicated on a Pentagon report that said that Venezuela is playing host to the Quds. The Quds, C-U-D-S, as it's spelled, are Iranian shock troops. They're the ones that would carry out assassinations and so forth, kind of like commandos. They have a growing number of Quds stationed in Venezuela. We know there are also terrorist training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil meets Argentina and Paraguay. So how hard would it be for somebody from the Middle East who lives in Latin America for 5 or 6 or 7 years, immerses himself or herself completely in the language, and then heads for the United States and claims to be a Latino? I was an immigration agent for 30 years. I can tell you without any equivocation, as my colleagues could tell you if you ask them, there is no way on God's green earth that you can sit across the table from another person and know with certainty where they're from. If you have somebody from Iran who can speak fluent Spanish, has the dialect down flawlessly, knows the country of Venezuela or Mexico or whatever, and then claims to be Mexican, it wouldn't even be an issue for Muhammad to convince you that he was Miguel. So this is a very serious problem. And it's one that I want you all to be aware of. It's a problem that our government still seems to be ignoring. And in fact, about a month and a half ago, President Obama, appropriately enough, from Disney World, because I think he's in Disney World sometimes when he makes these statements, promised that he wanted to include Brazil on the list of 35 visa waiver countries so that citizens of Brazil would no longer need those pesky visas if they're coming to the United States for a 90-day visit, as though anyone's going to look for them if they go missing in America. It's estimated that there are fewer than 300 agents attempting to track down something on the order of 5 million or more visa violators. To call it a joke doesn't do it justice, because there's nothing funny about the situation. There's a couple of things coming up that I do want to tell you about before we run out of time. So if you have a pencil handy or you want to go to the website, you can see it there. But I want you to know that a few weeks ago, I had the distinct privilege of being interviewed by a young lady by the name of Tiffany Cloud. She's a broadcast journalist from Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Tiffany used to actually work for an advertising firm that was a block and a half from where my office was in Lower Manhattan. It's a funny thing how we do live in a small world. She's originally from Hazleton. Hazleton, as I mentioned earlier, is where I was the final witness at the trial, the federal trial, on the statutes that were enacted by the city government of Hazleton when Lou Barletta was at the helm as the mayor. Well, she came to my home. She is now has her own program, and with a name like Tiffany Cloud, well, her news program is called Storm Politics. And then airs on the local station, Channel 35, at WYLN-TV in Hazleton. But it's also available on their website. Their website is www.ylntv.com. So if you go to that website, you'll be able to see the videos. And what we did was we taped four 22-minute segments. It'll be actually 30 minutes because they had to allow for commercials. You know how that works. Someone has to pay for the gerbils to run around in the cage to make the electricity so they can broadcast. I always joke about the commercials. I only wish I had commercials on this program. Then we would have we'd be able to pay for what we're doing. But what's more important to me at this point is getting an important message out there to all of you who are listening. Well, anyway, over the next 4 weeks, they will be airing one segment per week repeatedly. And we'll be on Saturday, that's tomorrow, at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Monday at 8:30 p.m., all Eastern Times, and then Tuesday at 9:30 p.m., and then on Wednesday, they'll start with the next episode. So we did four episodes. When they've all run, they will be up on the website. So I would certainly ask you to check that out. Another thing that I'm extremely happy about, very proud of, is I am in a number of documentaries on immigration, but the most recent documentary that I did, I have to tell you, I think is the best. Not that the others were bad. They were all wonderful. So if the guys that produced the other films are listening, this is not a slight, guys. But I will tell you that Dennis Michael Lynch did a really great job of putting this film together, and it's called They Come to America. And the website, if you write it down, this is all one word, www.theycometoamerica.com. If you go to the website, you can see trailers, you can see what this film is about. Very important film. I think Dennis Michael Lynch is a little bit nuts, or as we say in Brooklyn, Meshuga. This is a guy who actually went down to the Mexican border, went into areas where local law enforcement don't go because of the risk of being shot at by the cartels who are just on the other side of the border. Dennis Michael Lynch is a crazy man, as far as I'm concerned, and a great American. I had the privilege of spending time with him, and when I say he's crazy, I don't mean that as an insult. I just think he took an incredible risk to tell a very important story. And again, you think about what Napolitano says, and then I want you to watch Dennis Michael Lynch's film, They Come to America, at theycometoamerica.com, and ask yourself if anyone is really telling you the truth. I keep winding up thinking about Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men saying, they can't handle the truth. Well, the problem isn't that we can't handle the truth. It's that our own government doesn't want to provide us with the truth. And that's the reason that I do this program. That's the reason that I'm glad you join me at the end of the week, each week on Fridays at 7 o'clock, because I believe that it is so vitally important that there be a place where you can go to get the straight facts. As Jack Webb used to say in Dragnet, the facts, just the facts. It's remarkable that it is becoming increasingly difficult, if not flat out impossible, to find news sources where you can get the truth, where you can get the facts, where you can find out what's happening. If anyone can tell you with a straight face that there's no spillover violence from Mexico, right there and then, that ought to convince you that whoever is saying it needs a nose job. We now know that hundreds of American cities are infested by the Mexican cartels. How this doesn't constitute spillover is beyond me. Back in 1988, I was the first INS agent who was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of DEA in New York City. Walter Connery, who I mentioned earlier, was my boss, called me in and told me that I was being assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division. I was very excited about it because it put me in the catbird seat. Because for those 4 years, when you're in the intelligence division, I had access to all of the DEA informants, all the squads. I could go out on the street and participate in narcotics purchases, in arrests, in executing search warrants. As long as there was a legitimate need for an immigration officer to be there, My job was to be there and work shoulder to shoulder with those tremendous agents, not only of the DEA, but the FBI, state police, city police, ATF, U.S. Marshals. It was a team. We worked closely together. And one day I got this bright idea, and I said, you know, I'm going to compile the statistics to find out who it is that DEA is arresting in the United States and in New York. And what's remarkable is that there's nothing in the law, they're trying to get the law changed. People like Congressman Steve King, who's one of my personal heroes in Washington. Steve is a friend and a true leader. They're trying to get a law passed where when people are arrested, they have to actually report the immigration status. I mean, what a novel thought. But there's nothing in the law about that now. And I wanted to find out who was getting arrested. The best I could find out was the country of birth for the defendants and whether or not they were foreign-born and so forth. Well, I was in shock because in 1988, hard to believe, 22 years ago, back then, 60% of the people that were being arrested in the greater New York area for drug trafficking and related crimes by the DEA and the DEA task force were identified as being foreign-born. Nationally, about 30%, one in three. Now, this is remarkable. So this has been going on now for decades, that foreign nationals have come to the United States to traffic in narcotics, commit other crimes, often crimes of violence, in conjunction with the drug trade, and we're being told there's no spillover violence? My gosh, I don't even begin to know how to address that kind of a statement. It is extremely disturbing that this is what passes for a transparent government. But you know something? My dad, may he rest in peace, was my biggest hero. Sharp guy. He was a construction worker. I'm a lifelong registered Democrat, for whatever it's worth, because I'm a labor guy. I think the construction workers who built this country still embody the can-do spirit that built America and that made America, America. But my pop always used to say to me that we teach people how they should treat us by demonstrating what we're willing to accept. What are we as Americans willing to accept? What have we demonstrated where our alleged elected representatives are concerned? When you can have a woman whose job is to protect us, protect our nation, and protect our citizens. What on earth are we talking about when we're being told that this is acceptable? This is not acceptable. She is supposed to be protecting us. How on earth is she protecting us if this is what passes for the truth? To say to us that somehow the borders are okay, they're secure, and there's no spillover? How on earth can anybody possibly make that statement? It makes no sense to me. I don't understand how anybody can make that statement with a straight face, yet she does it all the time. Folks, too many of our elected representatives have forgotten that they are supposed to be representing us. This is the point that we need to remember. This is wherein lies the problem. We the people have forgotten that we have an obligation, and the obligation isn't only to vote. And goodness, I mean, that's a big enough problem, it seems, these days, to get people to even vote in the elections. But what's even more incredible is that nobody seems to be reaching out to their elected representatives and telling them what's expected of them. And that, to me, is extremely disturbing, because if we are not willing to tell them what we expect of them, then how on earth are we going to ever get a government that truly represents us and does for us what we expect them to do for us? This is very, very troubling to me, and it's one that really has to stop. And only we, the people, can make that difference. And we're only going to make that difference if, in fact, we take our citizenship seriously, shoulder our responsibilities, and do whatever it takes to get the attention of those people who claim that they want to represent us. This is the job Americans must do. I don't care about political party affiliation, because I don't think either political party represents America or Americans. As a federal agent, I've often made this point, I'll make it again. I was not allowed to accept a cup of coffee. And we have politicians on all levels of government who go out there boasting about being the best fundraisers. I mean, could you imagine if a police officer or a federal agent, imagine if I went to my boss, Walter, and said, hey, Walt, you should be proud of me. I'm the best fundraiser in the office. They would have had me in handcuffs and dragged before a grand jury so quickly it would have left my head spinning, and rightfully so. But yet the politicians just rake in the money. This new court decision by the Supreme Court that unlimited money can be now collected by the super PACs. My gosh, we got the best government money can buy, but there is a way of offsetting it. There are 535 members of both houses of Congress. The U.S. Senate has 100. The House of Representatives, I call it the House of Corporate Interests, has 435. There are 300 million of us. We outnumber them considerably. We the people have got to get together. Let's forget about party lines and think about the other lines, the lines that surround our country, our borders. Let's think about the immigration laws that are designed to protect America and Americans, because that's why we have the laws. They are designed to keep out the criminals, the aliens with dangerous communicable diseases, the terrorists, the spies, the human rights violators. It's right in the law. Don't take my word for it, but those are the laws that I took an oath to uphold back in 1971. I did that job for 30 years, and I hope that my perspectives are helpful to you. I hope that getting the real truth is helpful to you. And I hope that you will make it a regular part of your routine on Friday evenings, 7 o'clock New York time, to tune into my program. I flew solo tonight because there were so many things I wanted to talk to you about, and I decided that I wouldn't be fair to a guest if I tried to get all this information out there while having a guest at the same time. But next week we will have a guest on the show, I suspect. Again, my goal is a simple one, to provide you with the truth that you probably aren't getting anywhere else. I always like to end commentaries with a simple statement that democracy is not a spectator sport. I'm going to use that statement again today. Democracy is not a spectator sport, so I count on you, my fellow Americans, no matter where you live, no matter what your political orientation, to make certain that you make your elected representatives accountable. And if not, make certain that they find a new way to earn a living, because they're certainly not earning their keep if they don't represent us, we the people. I thank you so much for joining me, everybody. I wish you all a terrific weekend. I look forward to joining you again next Friday at the same time and the same place. Again, please go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or please go to capsweb.org. Take care, everybody. Good night.